Hello, hello, hello. Here's Marlanka with another episode from Sri Aurobindo, Essays, Divine and Human. Truth is an infinitely complex reality, and he has the best chance of arriving nearest to it who most recognizes but is not daunted by its infinite complexity. We must look at the whole thought tangle, fact, emotion, idea, truth beyond idea, conclusion, contradiction, modification, ideal, practice, possibility, impossibility, which must be yet attempted, and keeping the soul calm and the eye clear in this mighty flux and gurge of the world, seek everywhere for some word of harmony, not forgetting immediate in ultimate truth nor ultimate in immediate, but giving each its due place and portion in the infinite purpose. Some minds, like Plato, like Vivekananda, feel more than others this mighty complexity and give voice to it. They pour out thought in torrents or in rich and majestic streams. They are not logically careful of consistency. They cannot build up any coherent yet comprehensive systems, but they quicken men's minds and liberate them from religious, philosophic, and scientific dogma and tradition. They leave the world not surer, but freer than when they entered it. Now, some men seek to find the truth by imaginative perception. It is a good instrument, like logic, but like logic, it breaks down before it reaches the goal. Neither ought to be allowed to do more than take us some way and then leave us. Others think the divine judgment can arrive at the true balance. One does for a time, but the next generation upsets that fine balancing, consenting to a coarser test or demanding a finer. The religious prefer inspiration, but inspiration is like the lightning, brilliantly illuminating only a given reach of country and leaving the rest in darkness, intensified by the sharpness of that light. Vast is our error if we mistake that bit of country for the whole universe. Is there then no instrument of knowledge that can give us the heart of truth and provide us with the key word of existence? I think there is, but the evolution of mankind at large yet falls far short of it. Their highest tread only on the border of that illumination. After all, pure intellect carries us very high, but neither the scorner of pure intellectual ideation nor its fanatic and devotee can attain to the knowledge in which not only the senses reflect or the mind thinks about things, but the ideal faculty directly knows them. Siddhis. Some men sneer at the siddhis because they do not believe in them. Others, because they think it is noble and spiritual to despise them. Well, both attitudes proceed from ignorance. It is true that to some natures the rule of omne ignotum pro magnifico holds, and everything that is beyond their knowledge is readily accepted as true marvel and miracle, and of such a temper are the credulous made. It is also true that to others it is omne ignotum pro falso, and they cannot forbear ridiculing as fraud or pitiable superstition everything that is outside the reach of their philosophy. This is the temper of the incredulous. But the true temper is to be neither credulous nor incredulous, but calmly and patiently to inquire. Now let the inquiry be scrupulous, but also scrupulously fair on both sides, even when they inquire. To be severe, and by that they mean to seize every opportunity of disproving the phenomenon offered to their attention. Such an attitude is good rather for limiting knowledge than increasing it. If it saves us from some errors of assertion, it betrays us into many errors of negation and postpones developments of the utmost importance to our human advance. I do not wish to argue the question of the existence or non-existence of yogic siddhis, for it is not with me a question of debate or of belief and disbelief, since I know by daily experience that they exist. I am concerned rather with their exact nature and utility. And here one is met by the now fashionable habit among people presuming to be Vedantic and spiritual, of a denunciation and holy horror of the yogic siddhis. They are, it seems, tantric, dangerous, immoral, delusive as conjuring tricks, a stumbling block in the path of the soul's liberation. Swami Vivekananda did much to encourage this attitude by his eagerness to avoid all mention of them, and at the outset of his mission, in order not to startle the incredulity of the Europeans. These things are true, he said, but let them lie hidden. And now, many who have not the motives of Vivekananda think that they can ape his spiritual greatness by imitating his limitations. There was no such weakness in the robust temperament of our forefathers. Our great rishis of old did not cry out upon siddhis, but recognized them as a part, though not the most important part, of yogic accomplishment, and used them with an abundant and unhesitating vigor. They are recognized in our sacred books, formerly included in yoga, by so devotional a Purana as the Bhagavad, noted in some of their processes carefully tabled by Patanjali. Even in the midnight of the Kali, great siddhas and saints have used them more sparingly, but with power and effectiveness. It would be difficult for many of them to do otherwise than use the siddhis, since, by the very fact of their spiritual elevation, these powers have become not exceptional movements, but ordinary processes of their thought and action. It is by the use of the siddhis that the siddhas sitting on the mountains help the world out of the heart of their solitude and silence. Jesus Christ made the use of the siddhis a prominent feature of his pure, noble, and spiritual life. Nor did he hesitate to communicate them to his disciples. The laying on of hands, the healing of the sick, the ashirvada, the abhishap, the speaking with many tongues were all given to them. And the day of Pentecost is still kept holy by the Christian Church. Joan of Arc used her siddhis to liberate France. Socrates had his siddhis, some of them of a very material nature. Men of great genius are usually born with some of them and use them unconsciously. Even in natures far below the power and clarity of genius, we see their occasional or irregular operation. the West, always avid of knowledge, is struggling, sadly hampered by misuse and imposture, to develop them, and gropes roughly for the truth about them in the phenomena of hypnotism, clairvoyance, telepathy, vouched for by men and women of great intellectuality and sincerity. Now, returning eastwards, where only their right practice has been understood, the lives of our saints, northern and southern, are full of the record of cities. Sri Ramakrishna, whose authority is quoted against them, not only made inward use of them, but manifested them with no inconsiderable frequency in his Leela. Well, I see nothing in this long record immoral, dangerous, or frivolous. But because Europe looks with scorn and incredulity on these so-called miracles and magic, we too must needs be ashamed of them, hustle them into the background, and plead that only a few charlatans and followers of false paths profess their use. But as for us, we are men of intellect and spirituality, ascetics, devotees, self-deniers, Vedantins. For these things we are too high, and we leave them to theosophists, immoral tantrics, and deluded pseudo-yogins. Well, let us have done with cant and pretension in all matters. There are no such things as miracles in this world of divine processes. For either there is no such thing as a miracle, or, if we consider more closely, everything in this world is a miracle. A miracle is literally a marvel, a thing to be wondered at, and so long as the process is not known. Wireless telegraphy is a great marvel. The speechless passage of a thought from brain to brain is a yet greater. Yet it happens daily even in the most commonplace minds and existences. But when the process is known, nothing is left to be wondered at except the admirable greatness of wisdom, width, and variety of conception and subtlety and minuteness in execution with which this universe is managed. Well, even that wonder ceases when we know God and realize that the most wonderful movements of the cosmos are but trifles and conjuring tricks compared with His infinite reality. And as it is with this city of science, which we call wireless telegraphy, and with this other city of nature, which is exampled in the momentary or rapid spread of a single thought or emotion in a mob, in a nation, an army, so it is with the yogic cities. Explain and master their processes, put them in their proper relation to the rest of the economy of the universe, and we shall find that they are neither miraculous, nor marvelous, nor supernatural. They are supernormal only in the way in which aviation is supernormal, or motoring, or the Chinese alphabet. Nor is there anything magical in them except insofar as magic, the science of the Persian Magi, means originally and properly the operations of superior power or superior knowledge. And in that sense, the occultism of the present day is magic, precisely in the same sense as the scientific experiments of Roger Bacon or Paracelsus. There's a good deal of fraud and error and self-deception mixed up with it, but so there was with the earliest efforts of the European scientists. The defects of Western practitioners or Eastern quacks do not get rid of our true and ancient yoga. For yoga is not a modern invention of the human mind. It is our ancient and prehistoric possession. The Veda is our oldest extant human document. And the Veda, from one point of view, is a great compilation of practical hints about yoga. All religion is a flower of which yoga is the root. All philosophy, poetry, and the works of genius use it, consciously or unconsciously, as an instrument. You see, we believe that God created the world by yoga, and by yoga he will draw it into himself again. Yoga is the birth and the passing away of things. When Sri Krishna reveals to Arjuna the greatness of his creation and the manner in which he has built it out of his being by a reconciliation of logical opposites, he says, "Behold my divine yoga." We usually attach a more limited sense to the word when we use or hear it. And we think of the details of Patanjali's system of rhythmic breathing, peculiar ways of sitting, concentration of the mind, and the trance of the adept. But these are merely details of particular systems. The systems are not the thing itself, any more than the water of irrigation canal can be called the river Ganges. Yoga may be done without the least thought for breathing, in any posture, in no posture, without any insistence on concentration, in full waking condition, while walking, working, eating, drinking, talking with others, in any occupation, in sleep, in dream, in states of unconsciousness, semi-consciousness, double consciousness. Yoga is no nostrum or system or fixed practice, simply an eternal fact, a process based on the very nature of the universe. Let us pause at this point for today. You've been listening to Auroville Radio, Sri Aurobindo's Essays, Divine and Human, read by Marlenka, with hopes that something of this will give more light into you to manifest. That's all for now. Marlenka signing off.
This is Auroville Radio, voices from the City of Dome.